It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, from background checks to banning certain types of firearms, we'll talk about public opinion on gun control measures here in Wisconsin. First, if you've been to the grocery store or farmer's market lately, you've likely seen mountains of zucchini and summer squash, or if you have a CSA or a garden, you may be approaching peak zucchini. What do you do with it all, especially if you find the vegetable a little bit boring? Fear not, zucchini can be used in a zillion different ways, and our next guest is here to share some tips and tricks on this week's edition of Food Friday. Amanda Shapiro is editor of Healthy-ish, that's Bon Appetit's wellness site. Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, are you excited about zucchini? I like zucchini a lot. I think some people, Amanda, find it kind of boring.
You know, I actually think that summer squash and zucchini are some of the most exciting and fun vegetables to cook with because there's just so much you can do with them. They're sort of this blank canvas and you can pretty much work them into any dish.
Is this a nationwide thing? Because here in Wisconsin, I think around the Midwest, there's a joke about don't leave your car unlocked because people will break in and leave zucchini behind. Like, does the rest of the country face this like zucchini glut?
Yeah, I think unfortunately it's true. It's true on the East Coast for sure. Our CSA here in New York is always really heavy on the summer squash and zucchini this time of year, and it will show up in the Bon Appetit offices just kind of out there free for the taking this time of year as well. So yeah, I mean, at least here it's just as ubiquitous.
Now, you shared links with, I think, five different Bon Appetit recipes, and they before we go into the particulars, they go in all sorts of different directions. Can you talk about the versatility of zucchini and other summer squash?
Yeah. So like I was saying, I really love this kind of vegetable because it is, you know, really nutritious. It's full of, you know, it's full of all of the good vitamins and minerals that you want out of any kind of vegetable. But it is, like I was saying, pretty much a blank canvas for doing what you want with it. So think of any dish from, you know, a pasta dish to a ground meat stir fry to any other kind of roasting that you want to do with it. It really can work in any different context. So my favorite thing to do with it probably this time of year, if you have a grill, is to do this, to grill it kind of plain, just with a little salt and pepper and olive oil, and then to marinate it after you grill it. So this is a technique that we used in a recipe in the grilling issue of Bon Appetit, our June, July issue, where you take it off and then you add this really flavorful kind of tangy, acidic sauce to it and let it sit and soak up all of that good juices and sauce once it's already cooked before serving it.
And that's really interesting to me, the post-marinade, because I marinate zucchini with vinegar and olive oil and spices before I put it on the grill. What's the benefit of that after-grilling marinade?
Yeah, so really the thing you want to do before you grill, or really before you cook it in most preparations, is you want to salt it, because salting gets a lot of the moisture out. And as everyone really knows, like the way that summer squash can go bad is kind of when it gets that watery mushiness, kind of bland and flavorless quality to it. So the salting ahead of time is really all you need to do to get it ready to cook. And then if you're doing it over high heat on a grill, and then putting that sauce on it after, putting that marinade on it after, actually, once all of that moisture is out, it's better able to absorb it back in. So you're basically getting all the water out and then letting, and then cooking it and then letting all of the, you know, those flavorful juices come back in.
And one of the recipes you shared with us was for a grilled summer squash and then with red onion and feta. So we've grilled it. Talk about pulling it together with the red onion and feta.
Yeah, I love that one. I made that over 4th of July. That recipe is from Claire Saffitz, one of our contributing food editors. And it does that technique exactly. So yeah, you're tossing the squash, the onion together. You're doing a little bit of salt and pepper. It's going on the grill. It's coming off. You're putting everything on the plate, just topping it with the feta, letting it sit with, I think the mix of, you're doing white wine vinegar for that one, a little bit more oil, and then it's just sitting in that mixture for about 15 minutes, but you can really leave it for up to an hour, and it will just get more and more flavorful and juicy and none of that kind of mushy wateriness.
Talking to Amanda Shapiro from Bon Appetit on this week's edition of Food Friday. We are cooking with zucchini. You can share your favorite zucchini recipe or style of cooking, or maybe you have a question for Amanda about how to use all that zucchini. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Amanda, before we get into more recipes, I mean, sometimes we've got that little zucchini we've just picked off the plant. Sometimes we go away for a week. We've got baseball bats in the garden, basically. Is it are they worse if we let them grow too long? I know they get more seedy over time.
Yeah, they'll get seedy. This skin will get thicker and thicker. So I would say, you know, if you're finding yourself with overripe zucchini or summer squash, the best way to salvage might be to peel the skin off, because the inside is still edible and you might want to cook it down a little bit more. Like we can talk about some of the techniques that will get it kind of softer and jammier. And that might be a better like strategy to use with them when they're a little overripe. But yeah, peeling is a good option if that's the case.
Sounds good. And yeah, talk about how to cook them down if they're a little overripe and tough.
Yeah. So one of my other favorite recipes is one that was part of our farmer's market challenge last year. So Healthy-ish does a farmer's market challenge every August where we ask people to cook 10 recipes, each of them featuring like an all-star summer ingredient. And summer squash, of course, is one of those ingredients every year. So last year's summer squash recipe was a squash and basil pasta. And for that one, you're really cooking the squash. You're doing this kind of long saute style where, you know, you add a little garlic and oil to the pan, and then you're adding your squash, which you just have to kind of quarter it lengthwise, depending on the size, and then slice it up. So you've got the sort of half moon triangle shapes. And then you just kind of turn down the heat and cook it. And you want to get it till it's really jammy and soft, and that might take, you know, 15 minutes, not a super long time, but longer than, you know, than you could otherwise if it were just more for like a stir fry. And that, once you add it to the pasta with a little bit of the pasta cooking liquid and a little bit of Parmesan and all of that good, delicious, you know, cheese and flavoring, then you're going to get something that's just, it's cooked down almost so you don't see it, but it just adds this wonderful texture and kind of hint of flavor and obviously all that nutrition into your pasta.
So it's almost like the zucchini becomes a sauce. Is that right?
Yeah, it sort of emulsifies into the sauce. Yeah.
Cool. And then that's long sauteing. How about a quick sauteing? This is probably the most common thing I'll do with zucchini.
Yeah. So this one is actually our farmer's market challenge recipe with summer squash this year uses this technique. And this is a little bit more kind of a classic way that people will cook summer squash. It goes in, you know, in again, a little bit of oil. And then you're going to just, again, kind of keep your pieces a little thicker, because in this method, you don't want them to, you don't want them to burn. So you're going to keep them maybe in like slightly like 2-inch chunks or 1-inch or 2-inch chunks. And then you're going to want to cook them in the pan and not let them, not move them for the first couple minutes, because you really want them to brown. So you want to get them into the pan, all on the same surface. So don't pile them on top of each other, because we can talk about that. That's one of the biggest mistakes people make with summer squash. So everything's kind of got its place in the pan, and let it cook for about 4 minutes, I would say, 3 or 4 minutes, until it's good and browned on the bottom. And then you're going to put some spices over it, some garlic, stir it up at this point, and let it kind of brown all over for another few minutes. So 4 minutes on one side, maybe 3 minutes on the other side. And in this preparation for this recipe, it goes on top of some homemade hummus or store-bought, if you want to use store-bought, and some ground lamb, and it's still delicious.
Let's talk about spices a little bit. Sometimes it seems like, okay, this vegetable goes best with this kind of spices. But with zucchini, you mentioned it's a blank canvas. I could see, you know, of course, Italian or Southwestern or Indian. It's really going to take whatever flavor you give it, right?
Yeah, and that's the great thing about it, is you can eat it on its own and use any spice you want, or you can incorporate it into a recipe with its own flavor profile, and it will fit right in. Like this lamb and spice summer squash recipe uses coriander, cumin, red pepper flakes, and it's a lot of spice. So you're really kind of coating the squash with the spice, and it holds it really well.
We're talking to Amanda Shapiro. She's an editor of Bon Appetit's Healthy-ish. She's with us to talk about the best ways to use zucchini. this summer. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite way to prepare zucchini and other summer squash? Do you have questions about what to do with all of it? Do you have some advice you want to share? Maybe a zucchini disaster that you've had. Did you find the wrong way to make it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about zucchini and summer squash in this week's edition of Food Friday. Amanda Shapiro is with us, editor of Healthy-ish for Bon Appetit's wellness site. Yesterday, by the way, was National Leave a Zucchini on Your Neighbor's Porch Day. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite dish that features zucchini and other summer squash? Do you like it fried, sautéed, roasted, grilled, baked into zucchini bread? What are your favorite things to do with it? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Francisco is with us in Beach Park, Illinois. Francisco, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to tell us about?
My grandma has this famous dish from Mexico. It's really quick, easy, and simple. You take chorizo, Mexican sausage, you brown it as you would ground beef. You grab some French bread, you cut off the ends and hollow them out. And you would put Chihuahua cheese stuck in the bread and you lightly toast it. And while the chorizo is cooking, you go ahead and chop up your zucchini, mix it in with the chorizo, right where it's tender, not too soggy, not too crunchy. And you just stuff that bread and there you go.
So, Francisco, is that like a zucchini chorizo torta, basically?
Exactly.
Nice.
Exactly. And then you can add whatever toppings are your favorite. If you want a little bit spicy, you just put one little spoonful of some crushed red pepper, or you can saute your jalapeno peppers inside with the chorizo as it's cooking down.
Love it, Francisco. Thank you so much. Amanda, I think probably a lot of different cultures have adapted zucchini each in their own way.
Yeah, I think that sounds delicious, too. And we did a recipe a couple years ago that was a flank steak with actually a zucchini salsa. So cutting up the zucchini into really small pieces and mixing it with herbs and vinegar and a little bit of olive oil, too. Like you can really, you're right, you can really add it to any cuisine that you can think of.
Francisco, thank you so much for that call. That sounds great. We'll go now to Mark with us in Richland Center. Mark, hi.
Yeah, hello. I was just reminiscing because lots of people throw away the zucchini when it gets too big. And I had some volunteer zucchini in the garden, and I didn't harvest it until long into the fall. And the stuff had gotten to be as big as a football. But I just thought, well, let's open it up and see what it's like. Most people at that point have already fed the stuff to the chickens or something. But by the time it gets to be that ripe, the texture of the inside has turned to like spaghetti squash, and it's still perfectly edible. So there's no reason to have to use the doggone stuff as, quote, summer squash, because you can use it later in the season as well.
Mark, thank you so much for sharing that. Amanda, have you ever let zucchini go long enough to use it as, like Mark does, spaghetti squash?
Yeah, you don't find that kind of thing around Brooklyn where I live, but I can imagine that tastes pretty good, actually, and especially if you're into the whole zoodle trend, you know, where you're using squash instead of noodles. I think that sounds like a perfect way to use overripe squash too, summer squash.
Yeah, my go-to's, Amanda, when I'm like, I don't want to saute again, I'll food process it and make it into a relish that I found online. There's a great zucchini relish recipe. I'm sure there's more than one out there. Or I'll freeze it and then, you know, middle of winter, make some zucchini bread. Do you have like some fail-safe recipes for, using a lot of zucchini for the future?
Yeah, you can definitely like food process it into shreds and throw it into just about anything. I know people who've even steamed it and frozen it and thrown it into smoothies all year long. So you can do that with actually a couple different vegetables, but with zucchini, it really just disappears into any kind of puree. Same with adding it to as a base to soups to kind of thicken them up and give them a little bit more heft and flavor, kind of like using it as like a secret ingredient. I've seen people even like throw the into brownies, muffins, of course. So like definitely can go sweet or savory.
Let's go back to our Food Friday callers now. Jill is with us in Rhinelander. Jill, hello.
Oh, good afternoon. I have a way to keep the zucchini from getting to baseball bat size. You harvest it when it's small, inch diameter, and you make icebox refrigerator pickles out of them.
That sounds great, Jill, but do they get too mushy when you're pickling them?
No. They're wonderful. They're great. No, they don't get mushy. It's 7 cups thinly sliced zucchini, summer squash, or a combination, and it's a cup of thinly sliced onions, a cup of grated carrot, and 1 green pepper chopped finely, and it's a cup of cider vinegar, 2 cups of sugar, 1 tablespoon of pickling salt, and 1 tablespoon of dill seeds. Combine all ingredients in a large bowl, mix well, refrigerate overnight, and then you can transfer that into jars. It fills up a 1/2-gallon jar, and it'll last at least 6 months if they aren't eaten up beforehand.
Jill, thank you so much for sharing that. I love Amanda doing fridge pickles. I never thought to do it with zucchini because I assumed they would just get, you know, they're so watery, they just get all mushy.
Yeah, I think that sounds delicious. I really want to try that.
Yeah, so let's see. Maybe we'll go back and write down that recipe. I don't know. You guys got that
I'll
in the producer's booth?
Okay. I'll send it down to the test kitchen.
Sounds good. Jill, thank you so much for sharing that. It's Food Friday. We've got Amanda Shapiro with us from Bon Appetit. We're talking about cooking with zucchini. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us next in Three Lakes. Mark, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My mother always made a mock apple pie out of zucchini. You pretty much take the skin off, take the seeds out, cut it up in chunks, and make an apple pie out of it.
And did she spice it like an apple pie, all the cinnamon and brown sugar and stuff?
Yes.
And now, when you were a kid, Mark, did you like zucchini pie?
I didn't have any other choice.
All right. Like it or lump it. Thank you so much for sharing that, Mark. So zucchini as a fill-in. I don't know why you need to fill in for apples, but there it is. You put the zucchini in the pie, Amanda.
Yeah, you know, it's not that far-fetched. I think that taking it to a sweet place is maybe not what I would do, but I think, you know, you could use it in a galette, which is essentially taking a pie dough and just, instead of making it the pie shape, or you could even do it as a savory pie, but slicing it super thin. If you have a mandolin, one of those, you know, super thin razors sort of that will make it into little, just little sheets like that, you can layer it and cook it on a flatbread or on a crust that you fold over like a galette. And it essentially is like a savory pie. So totally, totally doable, can be totally delicious.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Vincent with us in Madison. Vincent, hello.
Yes, hello. I've got a couple of recipes, but I'll give you the first one. You take a zucchini, and dice them up. Take artichoke hearts, cut them up a bit. Dice up some red pepper and some celery and onion and black olives, and saute all of that, and then add to that mixture, add a cup of chicken broth with a tablespoon of curry and a tablespoon of cornstarch, and cook that down a bit, and then pour that over boiled polenta on a dish.
Ooh. Okay, that sounds pretty good, Vincent. Thank you so much for sharing that one. For some reason, that reminds me, it's not really the same thing, Amanda, but something I wanted to get to. One of your recipes uses raw zucchini, a salad ramen.
Yeah, so that recipe is from Healthy-ish from earlier this summer, and it's inspired actually by a dish called Hayashi chuka, which is a sort of Japanese cold ramen dish. And so in that one, you're using ramen noodles, but you could also just use regular spaghetti, whatever you can find in the store. And it's super, super simple. I think people, sometimes you can overthink it with the squash, but it's totally easy to eat raw as long as you cut it thin enough. Again, you can use a mandolin or you can shave it on the sides of a cheese grater. Just get it as thin as you can, cut it into matchsticks. And in this recipe, we call for a mix of a few different vegetables like radishes, carrots, scallions, some cabbage if you have it, even other cucumbers. As long as you have 2 or 3 cups of a mix of vegetables, including summer squash, you can, all you really do is cook the noodles. You kind of put the vegetables, kind of arrange them really pretty on top. And then you have a simple dressing that's just some lime juice, some rice wine vinegar, or some rice vinegar, a little soy sauce, and some extra virgin olive oil. And then you top it with sesame seeds. It's so refreshing. It's a great way to eat pasta, but have it cold.
That sounds awesome. I've never tried cooking with, or I guess not cooking with raw zucchini. I think we have time for another caller or two. Bill is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Bill, hi.
I have a question about zucchini. Okay, when I make zucchini bread, I cut it up and put it in a freezer, and it gets all full of liquid. Do you use that liquid or do you throw it out?
Bill, thanks. When I do zucchini bread, I keep the liquid, Amanda. That seems to give it the right amount of gooshiness, if you will. What do you think?
I think it really depends on the recipe. So I think if you want to follow a recipe because it will add liquid. So you want to make sure there isn't too much other liquid in the form of anything else in the recipe. But if there isn't any other liquid in the recipe, I would say, yeah, it adds moisture. It's great to leave the water in is because it's going to be adding moisture to the bread or the muffins or whatever it is that you're making.
Thanks a lot for that call. Amanda, in our last few minutes, I mean, I cook zucchini in a lot of different ways, and I've already heard 6 or 7 new ones from you and from our callers today. Are you still discovering new frontiers in summer squash?
Yeah, always. I would say the technique of marinating it after you grill it was a big one for me last year. We did a marinated squash with hazelnuts and ricotta that used this technique, and that's really... I realized that it's not just grilling. You can actually use the same technique of marinating it after, even if you can do it after you cook the zucchini in the oven on super high heat. You can do it after you cook the zucchini in the pan on a cast iron, again, super high heat. It's like any technique that you're using to cook it, you can use this idea of marinating it afterwards. So getting the water out ahead of time, cooking, marinating, that's kind of my go-to these days.
And I will be trying it probably as soon as this weekend. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Amanda Shapiro, editor of Healthy-ish, that's Bon Appetit's wellness site. She was with us to talk about zucchini on Food Friday. Find a handful of recipes. Go to the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've got some links linked there, and you can share yours while you're there. Lawmakers around the country are calling for more stringent gun control measures following 2 deadly mass shootings this weekend. Some in Wisconsin, including Governor Tony Evers, are calling for universal background checks, more oversight when it comes to reselling guns, and red flag laws. But what do Wisconsinites think about some of the proposed changes? Our next guest has at least some of the numbers. Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette University Law School poll. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Now, compared to the rest of the country, Charles, what do we know about gun ownership numbers in Wisconsin?
Wisconsin has about the same level of gun ownership as we see nationally. That's in the mid to upper 40% who say that there is a gun in the household, either owned by them or someone else that lives there. National numbers are fairly similar, mid-40s, with a little bit of variation, and I'm sure a state-to-state variation, but Wisconsin is pretty close to where the national average is.
And Charles, you track a lot of things at the Marquette University Law School poll, politicians, people's attitudes toward elected officials, things like that. What kind of things have you been tracking over the years when it comes to firearm-related issues?
Well, the ones that we focus the most on are the ones that are also being talked about now on background checks, which we've been asking about since 2013, and also a ban on assault-style weapons or so-called AK-47s. We've been asking about that since 2013 as well. And since 2012, we've been keeping track of how many people have a firearm in the house.
Well, let's get into some of the numbers you've been tracking. Background checks, universal background checks, trying to close what some people call loopholes in our background check laws. What kind of support do you see for that here in Wisconsin?
Here, over time, there has been very high support every time we've asked about it. since 2013, we've never been below about 75% for the year. And in 2016 and 18, that was up in the 80% range, 85% in 16 and 81% in 2018. That also reflects national polling. If anything, more recent national polling since our last 2018 poll suggests that this number is nationally up around 90%. It's really quite consensual. And in a time of really polarized partisanship, one of the interesting things about background checks is that in our 2018 data, 76% of Republicans, but also 78% of independents and 86% of Democrats favored more background checks. So 3 out of 4 Republicans and nearly 90% of Democrats is a rare case of partisan agreement on any kind of political issue.
Right. I mean, it's hard to get into the 80s and 90s in the United States for, you know, puppies are adorable type statements, right? You don't see that kind of agreement on a potentially controversial issue in the United States in most categories, right?
Exactly. And I think the advantage here is that background check seems commonsensical to everyone. Another aspect of it is that background checks do not separate gun households from non-gun households. Of those respondents in a household with a gun, 78% supported background checks, and 83% of those without a gun said so. So again, whether you're a gun owner or not, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or not, or an independent, we're looking at over 75% support for background checks from all of those groups.
Before we move on to other survey data, as a political scientist, you see this widespread support from both parties, from gun owners and non-gun owners. Why do you think these kind of laws don't tend to be expanded at the state or federal level?
I think this is a great example where public opinion alone is not enough to promote or to force legislative action. Some of that is because of interest groups and lobbying from the gun manufacturers and gun owners and gun lobbyists more generally. Campaign money is another part of that. But some of it is also on voters, and that's the question of intensity. Seeing 3 out of 4 who support background checks is not the same as saying 3 out of 4 will march down to their legislator's office and pound on the desk and demand action. And there is one of the real asymmetries in the gun issue of very long standing, and that is the strongest proponents of gun rights are also the ones most activated by this issue. And those who would restrict guns or impose background checks and so on may very well sincerely believe this, but they don't back it up with the political action and the demands of their elected officials.
Talking to Charles Franklin from the Marquette University Law School poll, looking at public opinion in Wisconsin when it comes to issues related to firearms. Charles, you also mentioned that you've been tracking the idea of banning certain categories of weapons, and I know there's a lot of argument over what fits into these categories, but people often say assault-style weapons. When you ask people in Wisconsin, what kind of answers do you get about that kind of idea?
Yeah, there's a majority support for a ban, but it's only 54% now that support a ban and 42 opposed. And here we see the polarization that we're used to by party, with Republicans substantially opposed to a ban, Democrats substantially in favor. And in this case now, gun owners more opposed to a ban compared to non-gun households. So polarized on the assault weapon ban, contrasting with the widespread support for background checks.
Have you seen fluctuation on this issue, on the idea of banning these assault-style weapons over time?
There's been a little bit, but on both of these items over the years that we've been asking about them since 2013, there's been modest shifts. Sometimes in the immediate aftermath of a mass shooting, we'll see support go up a little bit, but we have not seen strong trends over time, as we have seen with some other issues, where support has been steadily building or steadily falling. Instead, it's been pretty stable with a little bit of bouncing up and down, but not a big trend.
One issue that you haven't been tracking, but it's coming up a lot more in the last couple of years, the idea of red flag laws, the idea of, okay, are there kinds of behavior where police or other authorities should be allowed to remove the guns from the possession of a person who presents danger? Is there any polling out there that you've seen on this issue?
There is, though it's a relatively new issue, so there's not as much. What I have seen in reputable national polling suggests that that is more like background checks. A substantial over two-thirds supporting that, sometimes well over two-thirds depending on the poll. But it also is sensitive to how the question is framed. Does it include things like with a judge's order or with a chance to present counter evidence and so on? But it does look like on that one there's substantial support.
You mentioned the asymmetry on the gun issue people have looked at over the time, meaning that gun rights supporters tend to feel very strongly about this, whereas there's kind of a more diffuse, less organized, less emphatic feeling on the other side. Some people said after the Parkland shootings and the survivors of those shootings really being part of organizing, that was starting to change. Is that something you think is true, or is that something that maybe peaked and may have fizzled?
I think there is at least a subjective sense that there is more intensity on the gun control or restrictions or however you want to phrase it. But I think the caution is we have seen so many mass shootings over the last 15 years. And after each one, there's a short-term ratcheting up of intensity. And it's very hard to sustain that, and we've seen it sort of slack off a little bit until the next mass shooting comes. So I don't think we yet see this issue reaching the same level of intensity among those who would restrict access to at least some kinds of weapons or restrict access to for certain people, who, like with a red flag law or with background checks.
A thought or a question, Charles, on the politics surrounding this as we head into 2020 elections. There's been concern from Republicans that they're losing seats in suburban districts that they used to be able to count on, and that one of the reasons is this issue of gun control. Is that a trend you've been watching or watching out for?
Sure. I think that is potentially a vulnerability for Republicans, as we've seen suburbs that have been traditionally strongly Republican shifting away from them. We saw that in Texas in 2018. But here in Wisconsin, we've seen some weakening of Republican support in the Milwaukee suburbs and in some of the Green Bay area. So I do think that's part of it. How much to attribute that specifically to the gun issue, I think, is not entirely clear at this point.
Now, how would you as a pollster try to suss that out?
Well, part of it is by looking at responses to questions on these issues. And does that predict people's reactions to, party officials, whether that's the governor, the president, members of the legislature, also demands or support for legislation? I think one thing that's lurking here is when we ask people whether new gun control laws would really reduce mass shootings, people are pretty pessimistic about the effectiveness of that. Only about a third say it would have a decent effect on reducing it, and two-thirds say new gun laws wouldn't really make much difference. Until someone presents a strong case that new laws would be effective in reducing these shootings, I think they are facing a bit of an uphill battle, because if you may support background checks but still believe that it really won't make that much difference.
Charles, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll. He joined us today to talk about public opinion in Wisconsin when it comes to gun control measures. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, power is coming back on in Green Bay after a storm hit the city on Wednesday. We'll get an update on the recovery during our state news roundup. Now, also in Green Bay, the writing isn't on the wall. It's actually going onto the sidewalks. As part of a public arts project to promote poetry and walking, new sidewalk slabs will be printed with some short poems written by residents. Green Bay is following in the footsteps of Appleton, which has been printing poetry on concrete for about 6 years now. Laura Schley is the Green Bay Public Arts Coordinator. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Paula Vandehei is Director of the Appleton Department of Public Works. Paula, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me as well.
Paula, I want to start with you. You've got some of this poetry on the ground already. Tell us how this this idea, putting poetry on the sidewalks, got off the ground in Appleton.
Yeah, it was actually at a conference in Chicago a couple years ago, and there was a person there from St. Paul, Minnesota, and he was talking about how he created the sidewalk program there. So I brought it back to Appleton, and we are actually in the sixth year of our sidewalk poetry program.
And Laura, I'm sorry, Paula, talk us through how this works. What are the steps in going from the creation of a poem to walking on it?
Yeah, so the first thing we do is we reach out to our school district as well as all of the residents in Appleton, and we ask them to create poems for us. They submit those poems. We have a selection committee that then meets and selects five poems each year, and we get about 300 poems that get submitted. And then once we pick the five poems, it's really neat because they come and read their poems at a city council meeting. So it's actually usually a pretty emotional night for the poets to get to read their poems. And then we create stamps, and each poem gets stamped in about three different locations throughout the city.
And Laura, I understand you contacted Paula about that Appleton project. What made you want to pick this up in Green Bay, too?
Well, as the public art coordinator, we work a lot in visual arts, and visual art is seen as public art normally, but there wasn't a whole lot of emphasis on the literary arts, and poets need to be included in that as well.
And where are you at in the process of getting your sidewalk poems laid down?
We actually just received our stamps in the mail last week, so we had a fun time opening them up. And we just selected our first five locations to imprint them, hopefully later this month.
Now, describe the stamp. What is that? Is this like a big, you know, sidewalk section, like, sized thing?
Yeah. Ours average probably about 28 inches wide, or deep, sorry, by 45 inches wide. And then they're just made out of, like, a high-density plastic that has some handles attached to it. And thankfully, the contractors know how to install it and have it all look great.
Paula, talk about the form of the poetry. I know you got a rule you have to follow if you write a sonnet. There are rules if you write haiku. Are there rules to make the lines fit in the sidewalk square?
Yeah, so we say that we at maximum you can have 10 lines, and then there can only be 35 characters per line. So it's, as Laura said, they can only be so big. The poem has to fit within one sidewalk square, which is 5 by 5 feet. So sometimes we get poems that are, you know, a couple thousand words long, and obviously that's just too large to print into a sidewalk square. So we do provide those guidelines each year for our poets to follow.
And what kind of response, Paula, you mentioned you get hundreds of poems submitted. What kind of response do you get from the public as people are walking around and starting to see these things?
Oh, people love it. In fact, we have a biking group that creates a bike route each year, and then they go and they bike around the community, and then they stop at each poem, read it, and then have a little conversation about, you know, what that poem means to them, because part of art, obviously, is not everyone has the maybe same idea of what that poem means to them. So kind of that conversation is one of the things that we really like about the poetry.
Talking to Paula Vandehei from the Appleton Department of Public Works and Laura Schley from the Green Bay Public Arts Department, talking about a project that's been going on in Appleton starting now in Green Bay, where residents write poems and they get stamped into sidewalk squares for people to read, enjoy, and make bike routes around. Laura, can you talk about the role of public art in cities like Appleton and Green Bay?
Public art is really just a great tool that communities can use to make it a place that people want to visit and hopefully live at and start their lives and families. And it's just a really great way to create an identity for a community in a nice and accessible way for everyone to hopefully appreciate, and if not, at least start a conversation from it.
And Paula, talk about the value. I mean, you could have picked famous poems from all of human history. Talk about the importance of having these be things written by local residents.
Yeah, some of the feedback we got is just the feeling of pride that people get when they wrote something. You know, they created it, and now they get to see it in their community. The teachers from the school district also just, like, really thank us because they said sometimes when you give that school assignment of, hey, guess what, you have to write a poem, it wasn't that exciting. And now they just say, like, oh, the kids get so excited because they think, what if my poem that I write, you know, ends up getting stamped in the sidewalk? So we get really good feedback from the teachers as well.
Laura, are you hearing that in Green Bay? Are you hearing from schools, or are they participating in these projects?
Absolutely. We had two classes actually submit a bunch of poems, and those were a delight to read through.
And Paula, you've been doing this 6 years now, I think, in Appleton. Is this something you're just hoping to keep going as long as you can?
Yeah, it kind of has a life of its own. So once you start something like this, I think it'll be really difficult to end it. But, and we don't want to end it. We have created a map that's on our website that shows where each of the different poems is located. And obviously we have so much, you know, so many neighborhoods to cover yet. So we're excited to keep it going.
Laura, when you've got the stamps in hand, as you mentioned, how will we be able to find poems around Green Bay?
Once we get them installed, then we're also going to be developing a map that'll be available on our website. And we're currently in the process of developing a physical paper copy of an art map for Green Bay as well.
Paula, can you talk about some of the other public art things you have going on in Appleton?
Yeah, so one of the things, so as Director of Public Works, what I try to do is say, hey, let's find ways to have public art with the things that we're already doing. So examples, obviously, is Public Works Department has snowplows. So we've worked with the students to paint our snowplows each year with different winter kind of themes. So something that probably sometimes irritates our residents, having the plows come down the streets, now maybe bring some joy. We've done, you know, mural painting on our walls. We have some mandala artwork on our parking ramps. Bridge painting, sidewalk chalking, just kind of anything where we already have that infrastructure, and we just try to make it open to, you know, opportunities for art in the community.
And Laura, you've got the poems coming to your sidewalks. What other public art can we look for in Green Bay?
Well, last week we actually just unveiled a new mural on the Broadway District, and they're going to be getting another one later in August here, and we'll be installing another mural over on Adams Street in September. And then we're also working currently on our bus shelter art project, where we're getting local art submissions that are printed in vinyl, and then we're going to be attaching those to some bus shelters throughout the city.
Laura, as we start to wrap up, if people think, yeah, I want my poems literally carved in stone, how can they submit for next year's round of sidewalk poetry?
Well, I'm definitely intending on continuing the program next year. We always release our calls for artists or poets or whatever it may be on the city website, and we share that through Facebook, and then I send out email notification for our artist database. So if people are interested in being involved in future programs, we have an artist database that people can sign up online, or they can always give me a call.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Paula, you were inspired by St. Paul. Laura and Green Bay were inspired by you at Appleton. If another community, somebody in another community is listening, saying, yeah, I want to do this too, how do they get started?
Yeah, they can definitely shoot either Laura or I or email. We'd be happy to share. You know, we have all the specifications, guidelines and stuff like that. We'd be happy to share what we've learned through the program with any other community.
We'll leave it there. Thank you, Laura, so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Paula, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Green Bay Public Arts Coordinator Laura Schley and Paula Vandehay, Director of Appleton's Department of Public Works. We talked to them about public art projects that bring residents on board to write poems that are then stamped on sidewalk slabs in each of their cities. Hey, if you have a favorite local public art project, take a picture and send it to us. Email ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Show some local pride there. Time for some bird news. Bird news one, if this Polly wants a cracker, give Polly a cracker. Researchers working in New Zealand discovered a fossil of a giant parrot. Latin name, Heracles inexpectus. Nickname given by the researchers, Squawkzilla. Here are the numbers. The bird bones date from 16 to 19 million years ago. The bird was almost certainly flightless. It would have weighed about 15 pounds, stood about 3 feet tall. The biggest parrot species currently alive weighs in only at about 3.5 pounds, so 15 pounds here. Bird news number two, some bird news you can use. Have you ever tried to eat stuff at a beach and had gulls try to steal your food? Researchers at a gull-plagued resort town in England have a solution, maybe. Stare at the birds. In their informal experiment, birds that were stared at by people were more likely to fly away instead of taking your food. Even if they did take your food, they thought about it for longer than a bird that didn't have someone staring at them. But still, you know, keep your hands on the chips and the hot dogs, you know, pull them away if you need to. And a fact I ran into, I call them seagulls. You probably call them seagulls. Turns out there's no such thing. That's not a real type of bird. It's just sort of a generic word we use for gulls, terns, and other kinds of sea birds. So no seagulls, except a flock of. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.